Welcome. In this episode, we're going to be talking about what's possible with text-based LLMs and the types of products that can be built today. So when we look at the top 50 Gen AI consumer web products as of March 2024, there are about seven main categories of products. Half of these web products fall within either the content generation or the content editing categories. The next category, which is also the fastest growing category, is companion apps. The biggest of which is called character.ai, which describes itself as personalized AI for every moment of your day. So for an idea of the growth in this category, character.ai has an average of 298 sessions per user per month, with users spending an average of 2 hours a day on it. Meanwhile, ChatGPT has an average of less than 30 sessions per user per month. When we look at the remaining categories, they are productivity, making up only about 14% of the top 50, general assistants like ChatGPT and Claude, model hubs, so like Hugging Face and Replicate, and then search category products. In our conversation today, we're going to be talking a lot about how quickly the space is moving and the risks of building something that isn't useful enough or it's just too rushed to market. Even if we only look at OpenAI's GPT marketplace, there are currently over 2 million developers building products through their API. It's hard to follow and even comprehend what all of these tools are and why you should use them. So as developers start to focus on AI native workflows and integrations of multiple AI tools, it's only going to become more convoluted. So it feels like we've leapfrogged straight from having a first generation iPhone straight into an overflowing app store. There's just an unlimited number of rushed and questionably useful Gen AI tools out there. So today we're going to be talking about how we build something that's actually providing value to real humans, how to take the appropriate time and build that strategy without getting left behind, and how the role of the designer is still key in this product strategy.
So we'll be talking today with Peter Van Ditch. He's a wonderful, hilarious human being who has worked a long career in agency world. He's handled clients like Google and Goldman Sachs, but now he runs an AI LLM-based agency. I've had numerous chats with him, and he has so many insights into what can be built today, how you build it, and just the hilarious similarities that exist between building an AI tool today versus using the same human-centered design characteristics as a couple of years ago. Now, to what Brittany was saying, there's some interesting facts here. The fact that OpenAI is actually one of the lower used applications versus some of these others is fascinating. So what does that mean? Does that mean that other groups are more successful at it? Is it that the hype cycle is kind of coming to an end? Or is it that, you know, we just haven't seen enterprise applications that are actually going to drive the real value? What do you think?
Well, I think, honestly, the thing that's crazy is that it's not that ChatGPT is underused. ChatGPT is still the most used and highest traffic, both on mobile web and or on mobile app and on website versions. But the thing is that people are just spending very little time on them. They're not necessarily going back throughout their day. They're using it fewer times on any given month, but they do still have a high amount of traffic. But I think what it's really telling us is the ways that people want to be able to use Gen AI is shifting away from just simply asking questions to having a higher purpose.
Yeah. Now, in our previous conversation with JP, we talked about agencies. We talked about how they're using them, and he flagged that the most valuable piece was in the piece of co-pilots and agents, and those didn't show up in your stats. So it keeps raising the question of whether the initial rush to market were, you know, those quite honestly not necessarily super useful apps that were just proof of concepts. And over the next year in 2024 and 2025, we're going to get some actual useful products that are going to churn away and push everything else out. It'll be interesting to see what Peter's played with and what it means from his perspective.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just a final note on that is, you know, those general assistants are still really popular, but they only make up about 10% of the top 50 consumer products that are available right now. And I think partly that space is already really widely owned, but that, you know, again, more importantly, people are looking for specific use cases. They're looking for something that provides more value than just a generalized assistant. And, you know, something I thought was really interesting with, you know, something that Peter can really touch on is the fact that those assistants have now sort of become the operating system or the baseline that is being built upon. And they're changing so quickly that the differentiation between them is even becoming less and less and less. And so it's, you know, products are not being defined by what they're built on anymore. It's being defined on the value and the humanity that they're bringing to the user.
Yeah, so this week there was a demo released by Devin, which is a coding agent that works with you to build software. And what's amazing from a design perspective is you can actually watch it build. You can watch it reference and seek out information. You can chat with it as if it's a real person. So we're starting to get into a world now where we're not only working with APIs directly, we're actually interacting in very human senses with an intelligence. Now, Peter, again, he comes from a design background, so it'll be interesting to see what he thinks on that. But we're starting to see different modalities. We're starting to move beyond just prompts as the core definition. How do you interact? And that's going to open up some unique opportunities. It's going to change how designers interact with it. It'll change the entire field of UX and what it means, which is a good thing. So let's go over to Peter and see what he has to say on this topic. Thanks, everybody. Hey, Peter, welcome. It's always such a pleasure chatting with you. And I've not seen someone dive so deep into one specific area as I've seen you. You know, we were just chatting before this and you're saying that you're too busy to keep up with the news in your own field, which is a good sign. Now, I'd love to know, you know, to that note, we were chatting that you hadn't had a chance to watch the John Maeda talk. And the beauty of that chat, which I think was really engaging, is he used to work in MIT's media lab. He'd been working on AI for many years. He's written extensively about AI. And the thing is, it's almost like we've totally had this mass forgetting, in a sense, that all this stuff existed before 1 year ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, your world in AI, did you have little interactions with it pre-LLMs?
I'm going to say, yeah, I had a little practical interactions with it. So I was aware of machine learning, this and that, right? But it seemed to be a lot about numbers. And so it wasn't impacting the day-to-day work, mm-hmm. you know?
Because you're, like us, you are from the design world. And like us, I'm assuming you've been looking at these tools and they seem like computer science gadgets, right?
There was a time about, I'm going to say 10 years ago, when data became really important to UX, UI designers, right? And so before that, mm-hmm. we had Google Analytics and it wasn't much. And then at some point, the data tools became really good. And we became aware of, oh, we can measure how many people click on this button and we can find out the user journey. And we kind of incorporated that, right? And, you know, for me personally, like the whole AI world, I was like vaguely aware of it. But until last year, I wasn't like using it in my day-to-day job.
But your day-to-day job 2 years ago, you were building some pretty complex products. You were involved in some pretty complex digital interventions.
Exactly. Building complex products, but not with AI as a material. And today we are.
What is possible today with text-based LLMs that wasn't possible 15, 18 months ago?
Okay, so the amount of stuff that is possible today, and I think that's why everybody's so excited, is just unimaginable, was unimaginable 2 years ago, right? So you can generate an image, you can analyze, you know, a 200 page PDF in seconds, you can interact with voice, you can write grammatically, you can correct your grammar, you can translate what you're saying live, like all those things, that is just an enormous amount of things that today we can do. And we haven't even, you know, we're just starting to be like, oh, we can do this. Oh, we can also do this. Could we do this? Well, suddenly the answer is yes, right? So there's mm-hmm. just all these capabilities now, and we're just starting to explore. And they are very new. They are very different. They are different from, like, when the internet came out, we had a whole bunch of new capabilities, right? When the mobile phone came out, we had a whole bunch of new capabilities. Now, suddenly, you could be standing on the corner and push a button, and a car appears, right? This was a new thing.
Yeah.
Today, there's this whole bunch of new capabilities, and we don't know yet all the things we can do with them. Like, and I look around and I see normal people, not in the industry. I see normal people using this for all kinds of crazy stuff, usefully, in a manner that's not just like, oh, it's cool and new, but like, it's that I don't care that it's new, but it's useful to my day to day, right?
Yeah. Now, you build products for clients, and clients are, in this case, usually mid-sized corps, right?
Mid-sized to large-sized corporations, mostly in the US, yeah.
So we're all exposed to, you know, these little functional time savers, you know, the transcription tools, the image generators. They're not true business cases, right? They're little add-ons. What are some of the real meaty business cases that you think are going to transform some industries that you're seeing out there?
Yeah, nothing but easy questions. So there's one set of things that if you have been in an enterprise context for a certain amount of time in your career, that, you know, there's a whole set of like back office processes that are effectively somebody with a certain amount of knowledge doing some work that is repetitive, boring, not interesting, and they do it all the time, and they have floors full of people doing this, right? Copying and pasting Excels, answering RFP questions, etc., 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 reviewing insurance claims, right? Like all this stuff that is around, especially things that is text but also images, that a person has to do today that is not creative, it's not interesting. Like for me, that's like, you know, level one innovation. It's very obvious, it's very easy to say, oh, we have, you know, I'll give an example. We have, you know, a team of like, you know, 48 people in middle America somewhere doing some back office work, and it takes, you know, 4 weeks, and we would like that to be done in 10 minutes instead. And today, those kinds of things tend to be possible. So that's one level of just like an enormous amount of back office work that happens everywhere. That's the immediate ask we're getting from clients.
So we see over and over again right now that so many of these AI tools, especially the text-based ones, are really singularly focused on what they do, right? It's like they have one kind of niche that they will cover. But I think where things are going to start to move to, and I think you sort of alluded to this, is that idea of these more integrated systems. How can these text-based LLMs and these, you know, GPTs start to actually integrate and work off of each other? So whether that's through like RAGs, retrieval augmented systems, or through, you know, through just them talking to each other, that's when we're really going to start to see some of that power, right? Some of the ability for these AI systems to really provide value. Are you starting to see people looking for that level of power in the tools that they want, or are we still pretty far away from that?
I think they are. I also think there's this interesting spectrum of like people wanting this to do everything and solve all their problems, and it won't, because not every problem you have is a problem AI, you know, or machine learning will solve. I think we're just in the next few years, we're in a time of there's a lot of things we have to try. When you were like walking through that framework, like I had to think of the RFP example, because you can easily imagine, you know, the tool answers the RFP and then the tool also writes the RFP. So now you have two AIs talking to each other. But what are they really doing? They are negotiating capabilities between two companies, right? And so shouldn't you just do that versus having a document generation step in between? But there is stuff like that everywhere. And I also feel like it is non-predictable. Like I can't say what's going to happen. I can't say where the real impactful use cases will be. I think, you know, nobody can. We already see like a whole bunch of use cases that are extremely useful in lots of different domains. Which, by the way, I think is what proves out that this will actually be a useful technology. But I kind of feel like it's like in 2007 when the iPhone came out, you did not know Uber was going to be a thing. We didn't know because then a few years later it was. So I feel we just need build stuff, experiment, and in 5 years, looking back, it'll all be clear, you know? And we were like, man, I should have bought stock in this company.
I know you come from an information architecture background and agency background, but let's focus on the information architecture piece. The web was named because it was interconnecting documents and routing of information. This is a whole new type of architecture. What does it look like in your mind, and what is it capable of?
Okay, I'll say two things. So one, I've been very surprised at how useful the information architecture skills suddenly are again. You know, things like understanding information during content audits, like understanding the structure of it, that all suddenly becomes super useful because the large armies of engineers that are like if I'm an engineering organization and I say, give me your, you know, 12 million documents in your company and I'll make them useful, it's not going to work with just engineering. You still need those AI skills. So as a side note, I've been surprised, like, oh wow, all these skills are really useful again in this new world.
Now, to that point, one of the things that John Maeda hinted at, and he talked about, you know, this grid, this Rumsfeld matrix, and he's talking about how right now LLMs are focused on known knowns. Now, someone listening and watching, it seems so obvious, right? Known knowns. But Brittany and I, we've worked with many clients where the point of information architecture is to make what already exists more discoverable because people have forgotten it even exists.
And in big part,
this is the irony. So I know you are particularly working on making information more discoverable and generating new value through it. What are some examples that you're seeing in that realm?
I don't know if I can actually speak of this example because it's not live yet, but I'll say it generically. So generically, if an organization has, you know, 15, 20 years of expertise built up, and we all know, you know, we've all seen knowledge management systems fail. We've all been around companies. We've all seen that, you know, we reinvent the wheel every, I'm going to say 2.5 years, whatever the average tenure of the average person is, the wheel gets reinvented, right? I do think that is a very specific generic use case for AI because it just works really well. It can, and I'll give us another specific example that we are exploring with a different client, user research. So every large company does user research again and again and again, right? And they do user interviews and they do market research, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they pay for this fairly large amounts of money, hopefully, for it to be done right. And again and again and again, and it gets lost. Like 3 years later, that is no longer part of the organization's knowledge. So I you know, just seems like a, like unearthing, you know, not losing your memory seems like a very, I'm very optimistic about that. Because the LLM will still be there. It didn't go to a different company, right? It didn't quit. It didn't get fired in your round of layoffs.
Let's talk about unknown knowns. In this case, analytics platforms are there to help you understand the meta information happening in and around you. But most users are never aware that those things happened, the correlations of those things, the implications, and what direct actions need to happen.
It should let you know.
Now, are there other use cases that you've seen or pondered exploring this piece of unknown known and the value that it can deliver?
I think there's many. Legal, right? So legal reviews contracts, what they are looking for is like one line in like a, you know, 37-page document that they need to pay attention to. So I do think that the tech can be very good at saying, here are the things you need to pay attention to. You don't have to read, you know, like, you know, in practice, how does legal work? Like they have really long documents, they skim through it and they try to like pattern recognize the bits that they do need to redline and pay attention to. LLMs can do a lot of that. It's just, yeah, it seems like a logical use case. Is that?
I would say, I mean, I would say it is. You know, something that's kind of along this line, especially because we're talking about information architecture and accessing the information that exists, right? Something that I've been reading a lot about recently that I found really interesting around that space is there have been several researchers, like academic researchers recently, that have undertaken the idea of how do we understand prompt engineering and how can people actually get the most out of it? And what they've realized is that there seems to be very little consistency over what will work successfully when it comes to prompt engineering. And they're actually starting to move into the space of teaching the text-based, you know, LLMs to actually teach themselves. So basically they take a stab at doing the prompt itself, and it has significantly higher success and significantly lower bias when they're doing that.
Yeah, we use that technique. It's becoming common. So you ask the LLM to rewrite the prompt in a way that'll be more useful to do it in this and this and this way. I also think that if we are trying to teach people to write the right words to the LLM so they get the output that you know this, that they want, we're doing it wrong. That's not the point. It, you know, then what are you doing? You're just teaching them a useless skill, because the LLM in 6 months will react differently. So that to me is a bit, it's like, you know, it's like you're teaching people like that to dance in order to generate rain. That's not really a skill. The rain doesn't come because you dance. You know, sure, you can change your prompts and stuff, but I feel like if the LLM doesn't give you the answers you need, then it is not the fault of the prompt. It is, we need a better LLM. That's just like human-centered thinking, right? We're not going to like make you dance and write really weird prompts and like keep a library of prompts in your, you know, Word doc so you can reuse them. That's all just silly.
Is LLM design right now human-centered in any way, or are we in the Windows, you know, like 3 era right now?
I mean, Windows 3 was pretty human-centered. You could argue, okay, is LLM design human-centered? I think it is. It's mostly being designed by engineers. However, I'll give an example. So, you know, like OpenAI did Red Team GPT-4 for 6 months, right? So that is a human-centered behavior. Like, they, you know, they had people test it, find the problems, improve it. You were doing user testing on your thing because you were worried that it's not good enough or that it's going to say weird things. So I would say yes, there is some user-centeredness in it. I think the problem is more like the at a large scale, the people in the industry with like a user-centered background, like an HCI background or, you know, UX background, have felt maybe, I don't know how they feel, but, you know, maybe they've been a little like on the outside of this whole thing. And that's on them. I think the whole UX industry, the HCI people, etc. I don't know the answer, but like they need to be part of this much more than the other.
One of the biggest criticisms of the Google launch recently was the fact that I think they only did like 100 user tests or something like that before pushing everything live, because they were trying to compete. And the criticism is like, that's why there were so many issues with the way that the product output turned out.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, we've also very quickly seen, because anything that's like quote-unquote gen AI, generative, right? It's so open-ended. So a lot of stuff can come up, and it doesn't come up if you test it once or twice, right? It's going to come up like at some point at scale. So what we started to do now, like we do eval first, as in we spend time, a month, 2 months on evaluation first, before we actually build out the full product, because there's just so many directions in which weird stuff can happen that we find that very useful.
You build products for, you know, clients, right? Mm-hmm. Who's the end user usually? Is it, you know, someone in the C-suite? Is it someone like managers? Is it for the customers themselves? Like, who are you building for, and how do you bring in some of those HCI principles for them?
Talk to them. Yeah, it's a variety. So let me go over it. End users outside of the organization, exec suite, design team. So it is a multitude of users, right? Depending on what we are building. And yeah, my HCI background, I literally just go and talk to them. From that's why we do eval first, as in we start by talking to them. one thing I found is that so this is like a repeat of everything we already know. There's a lot of like superficial thinking in AI, as in, oh, why don't we do an AI that can do X, but without talking to the actual users and the people that are going to use it, and from an executive like bench, where the belief is that X is very simple, right? Whereas the actual work of those people is actually much more complex than that. So the first, you know, in the first few weeks, we go talk to the people that will actually use it, and we just had an example of that. And we dig in, we spend days talking to them, all the little details. But, you know, this is just how you build good products. It's not new to AI. It's just, you know, there's a certain amount of naivete in the AI world that, oh, it's AI.
So do you find work, so do you, you know? Find then that rather than, you know, ultimately, like a lot of these new AI tools and launches that companies are going to be having are effectively part of a digital transformation, right? Whereas are they thinking right now that it's more of like, oh, it's just a product or it's just a feature and we'll treat it that way? When in reality, especially when it impacts employees or people internally, there's much more transformation and shift in culture and workflows that need to happen.
Yes, I think it's very workflow based, and it's almost a business transformation, as in for one company, this opens a whole new line of business. It makes them become a different company. I think companies see the transformative potential of this, and that they are doing pilots and they are doing, you know, initial projects. You want to talk about value and outcome first, right? So the value and the outcome to the company tends to be much more than just, you know, a process improvement or saving some money or anything like that. It actually generally tends to not be saving money. It tends to be serving their customers in a different way, much better. So for example, my customer, this process usually takes 2 years, give or take. Can we do it in 1 year and 2 months with this new approach? That is, and it's not about cost. It's not about, can we save money, anything like that. It's just like, we are now dramatically more competitive than we used to be. You see what I'm saying? So it is like, it changes the business, which I like it. Those are nice projects to work on.
Yeah. So our last guest, he's in agency world, which I know you came from, and he was detailing out how he was messing around with the different Gen AI tools, and that he can basically research, validate, build a business canvas, build initial creative prototype wireframes and all that in maybe 1/100th the amount of time. And a lot of the conversation in that chat was, well, how do you evaluate that work afterwards? Is it about speed to market? Is it about uniqueness? Or is it simply about, you know, being able to deliver something equivalent?
Yeah, I have thoughts about that. Like, so because on the one hand, like if you have a process that is so inefficient that you can like 100x it faster while putting in the same amount of thinking and value, right, then your process was really inefficient originally. You know what I mean? Like I'm not biased. I'll give you an example. Some people, apparently, so I've seen on LinkedIn, have argued that now we can do user research with ChatGPT, right? I laugh out loud because it is just anybody, you know, it is just the silliest of ideas. It makes zero sense. You're not putting in any value. You're just putting words together and not understanding what user research is to start with. So,
but to that point, I do have, you know, counter question in a sense. Brittany and I have been tinkering around because some clients are really trying to find ways to automate, save time, like you're saying. And one of the framings that I've been exploring is, what if you could learn and quantify a persona so deeply that you can turn it effectively into like a design system, you know, a schema that you can regressively analyze so that you can predict who is in that group, their decision-making habits and such. Can you ever imagine us getting to a point where you can quantify human behavior and model it on a business by business basis?
I think there will be much simpler things with much larger impact. You know what I mean? Like it's like, okay, so when we invented the TV, it is not a radio with pictures, right? If when we invented the car, it's not a horse that goes faster. So I feel like we invented AI. Things are gonna work differently. We're not just gonna like do the same thing we did before, somehow magically better. I think that, you know, I think like a lot of business processes are gonna change. I think companies are gonna, you know, new companies are gonna come up that do things dramatically different because now there is a capability that didn't exist before. And that'll work. So it's not so much like
I think have you ever heard of the term digital chauvinism?
No, that's a good one.
The term digital chauvinism effectively means that that people will default or de facto think that a digital expression of something is better than the humanistic or the analog version of it, right? And I think my personal opinion is that, you know, the whole idea of like personas and personification aside, is that the idea of utilizing AI for customer research is effectively digital chauvinism, right? Because it's saying, you know, well, we can pretend to create these experiences for people to then give feedback on it, but ultimately you're just going to bring everyone to the mean, right? Everything will become the mean. I do think that something like personas and more on like the business strategy and business planning side of things is a little different, because everything does sort of start from the mean and the average, because that just is how you can look at a population. But when it comes to those one-on-one experiences and learning, you know, what someone actually experiences when they use something, it's so hard to say that you could just anticipate and imagine that from a population as a whole.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel the same. I think the hands-on stuff that requires thinking and experience and insight will become more valuable. The copy and paste workload, like I'll give you an example. We no longer have to transcribe audio interviews when we're doing user research, because now the tool can do that, right? Great. That's, you know, hours saved. So that saves a lot of time. Now we have time to think about it and to read it and to get the insights and discuss them, right? So that's how I see it. Like there are menial tasks, and many of them, processes, etc., that can go away, but the thinking doesn't go away. The discussion doesn't go away. The creating an organizational culture doesn't go away, right?
Peter, a question then, you know, just going back to, you know, your own work, who is it that should be building an LLM? Should it be open or closed? You know, we've been touching that this is a natural part of evolution of businesses. Is it that everyone should be building something of some form?
No. Companies should understand their business and understand how to do strategy, right? So if I am company X, my business, I'm a moving business. I employ 1,000 people and we have trucks and we move people to, you know, when they move. Should I build an LLM? Probably not. Like I should understand my business and I should consider whether there's any risk to it or any, you know, opportunities to it with these new capabilities. And if so, I might want to run a pilot and explore that, right? But that's the call you make. It's not about whether you should run an LLM or not. Doesn't matter, you know, like you're a business, right? You make business decisions.
So what would you say is the role of the designer or the role of design when we're talking about this influx of text-based LLM products and tools?
I think designers need to bring in the skills that they have that are less about visual and UI design. So understanding users, research, like those two are really big. We have a new capability. We don't know how to interact with it. We just talked about prompt engineering guides. That is ridiculous if you have an HCI hat on. So I think it's a lot of those skills in understanding humans. And then actually, there's another thing that I think is kind of cool. Like we spend the last 5-10 years building design systems, right? Because we're doing like UI design at scale. Great. just now use them. We have them. You don't have to like redesign the button. Start thinking about interaction with a system that responds to you in sentences. Great, like use your brain, like do that work. Like we have Figma set up, so that's the easy part.
Now that transition from style guides to design systems, what led to it? You know, what can we learn about that evolution in terms of how we apply it to data?
First of all, so let's take the last 10 years. What, you know, around 2010, every large company realized that this internet thing is not going to go away, and that this internet thing is not just the website, right? It is the app. It's how people interact with you. So after, you know, building agencies, using agencies to build their websites for like the first 15 years of this thing, they started pulling in, you know, building their own internal design organizations, hiring UX designers, hiring, like building that entire capability, then quickly realizing like, oh, we just need more and more of this. This is not going to go away. So let's build design systems so we don't have to like redesign the same, you know, drop down every 5 weeks or the same carousel, which that's the example I suffered with. Oh my God, the carousels. So, you know what I mean? Like there's no point. So they realize there's no point. Design systems work for that stuff. Then they spend a few years figuring out how to do a good design system. I feel those are now in place. And I don't think the current market in which, you know, those internal teams, then they really grew. They got really big, maybe a little bloated. Right now, the market flipped. Everybody's laying people off. So the design teams are being asked to lay people off. And they're being reduced. I don't think that's because of design systems, but I'm like, thank God we have design systems because the workload will go up, but at least we can handle it now, right? However, so that's the context of it. The whole AI thing opening up for me just lets those design teams go like, oh, wow, there's a whole new world to explore. We have value to add specifically from understanding users, research, those kind of skills. Let's dive in, you know, like let's do that.
Yeah, now you brought up carousels as the tedium and buttons, but what was the precursor to, you know, LLMs, right? Because if LLMs are there to solve problems at scale, how were we solving it before? Was it just like manual pulling of reports? Was it dashboards? Was it just the initial stages of adaptive design?
It was people in badly lit offices copying stuff from Excel forever. That's the problem I think LLMs solve to a large degree. Right now, that is the easy low-hanging fruit, right? Like back office work. That stuff wasn't even being designed.
That made me think of when CX really became a bigger deal. And, you know, I used to do a lot of work on the Qualtrics platform. And I remember they had created this CX tool that was effectively about creating dashboards. And you had to pay them like $5,000 to access it. And they're like, and you have to hire special agencies who can build it for you. And it just seemed ridiculous that you had this massive process to be able to take the data that you already own and make it usable. And so to me, it seems like, you know, this is really where that big evolution is coming, where you don't need specialized agencies and specialized engineers to be able to give you access to the data that you already have.
You know what that's making me think? Perhaps there's a real switch in what design is coming. Because at some point, design became... You know how originally in the internet, all the designers wanted to be creative and they were making all these pages with all these like funky, right, things? And then at some point, everything looked the same, and for good reason, I would say. Everything started to look the same for good reason. We built design systems. I kind of feel we're done with that, so that's great. Now those are done. I mean, you know, we'll still have work on them, but now let's do the... To me, it's just very interesting to start thinking about there's a new capability, a new material. How do people interact with that? What's the human-computer interaction? Right? This is really what it is. And how do we make that work? How does that work within a company, outside of a company, in a workflow? So it's all about people. I feel like maybe all the designers can finally get out of Figma and talk to people. And it's a good thing. It doesn't seem to me like a bad thing.
Are we going to end up in a point where you know, five platforms are going to dominate what the interaction model is going to be for these tools, or is it going to split out and diverge where each corp, each product going to have its own interface, its own language, its own, like,
I think we learned that. Feels to me like we learned that, for example, in digital, in the web, we converged on one interaction. You know, everybody uses the hamburger. You can argue the hamburger is not the best UI, but there it is. Everybody knows it. Everybody uses it, right? I think it'll be the same. I think in whatever these emerging little UI conventions and interaction models, et cetera, are, they're being defined now. And in about, you know, in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, they'll be set. And I do think those will be the standards. I'm not big on like, oh, we have to come up with a creative way of doing a dropdown. It doesn't, no, we have a dropdown. It works, it could be better, but you know, people know it.
Mm-hmm. So then when you're deciding to build, how do you decide between OpenAI or one of the other ones? Are there like a set of criteria that you use to decide, you know, this type of industry is better for this
right now,
is better for that?
So yeah, there are subtleties in use cases. It's moving so fast. I also kind of feel like right now, a lot of people use whatever they got an API key for first, you know, it moves so fast. So every month, this model now beats that model in these use cases. I mean, honestly, practically, I think you start with one. They're also fairly easy to switch. So not trivial at some, when you get to some complexity, especially around eval and stuff, but they're fairly easy to switch early on, right? You pick GPT-3 or Gemini or whatever, they're not crazy different and they are moving, they're climbing up the ladder together. So one goes up three rungs, then it's on top, then the other one goes up three rungs, then that one's on top. So, you know, selecting which API you use is not the biggest challenge right now. It almost doesn't matter to some degree. I'm not going to say it doesn't matter, but like this.
So what is the biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge is building things that are useful versus building things that look cool in a demo. It's very easy to build something that looks cool in a demo. But then it is not to the level of you only hit, you know, the demo happy path use case, which is 60% of whatever, but it's not actually useful. And to get to that 70, 80, 90, 99% of usefulness, that is the hard work. So, you know, it's very easy to like throw out something in a demo. I think that's a big challenge. The other big challenge is the thing we were talking about earlier, which is this perception naivete, perhaps. Oh, it's AI, so it can just solve stuff. It doesn't, right? Yeah, like you still have to think about all the stuff we were thinking about before.
For sure. So, you know, there's a lot of buzz right now about cloud, and obviously GPT or ChatGPT is launching a new version. What are really like the reasonable limits of what they're capable of right now, just so someone doesn't think that they have a magic bullet all of a sudden?
Okay, so I don't know what the limits are of what they are capable of, because it's evolving fast. Like, you know, I get blown away every few months. I'm like, oh, wow, we can do that? That's crazy. You know, every few months. So I do not know.
Setting realistic expectations. Like how can you walk in to a client and set realistic expectations? They might come in and say, you know, an unrealistic ask, something from their board. And, you know, you might push back and say, well, that might take 5 years. How do you evaluate the technology so that you actually can bring them solutions that are
viable? Yeah. So there's a few things. Like, so one, we push, you know how we used to do a discovery? We just push for like, we call it eval first. It's like 2 months of digging in, not just the tech, but also like the organization and the process and the people to see what we can actually do, right?
I have, I guess, a spin on the question that might help. So I was actually having a conversation recently with a previous client of mine, and he works for like a really big like IT-based company. And so one of the big questions that he was asking me about was, you know, everyone in there is so excited. It's like the space race. Everyone wants to, you know, to be like, hey, we need to start integrating, you know, AI. We need to, you know, have better chat capabilities, predictive capabilities, all these things. But they're also really risk averse when it comes to the fear of when they have done testing, they will, for example, have a chatbot that returns no response to something that's a very simple question. And so they're really trying to balance that thing between not being left behind, but also doing something that goes beyond the demo to that, you know, 80, 90% that you're talking about. What advice would you give that kind of a client about what they need to consider to do that?
Yeah, we do hear the same thing. It's like, oh, wait, but, you know, my cousin made a chatbot in a weekend. Why can't we? Like, I tell clients, like, listen, this is going to take, you know, 4 to 6 months. It's going to cost a bit of money. It is a real product. Stuff takes work. We're going to have to do eval. We're going to have to look at risk. We're going to have to work with the team. We're going to have to look at the process, right? Like, it's not trivial. And I feel that that's the same, in a way, it's the same as saying like, oh, but my cousin made a website in, you know, the weekend. Why does this website have to cost this much money? Well, because you're getting something professional. So companies that are used to that technology is worth spending time on, they understand, yeah. Or you can get something that makes a difference to your business and invest in that.
I'm just trying to think of a great last question to close us out. But I think, you know, you've brought up so many good points about what to consider and what to think about when actually coming up with a product. So maybe what I'll do is I'll ask you something that's a bit more about your own thoughts or your own take on it. But, you know, if you were to put on your lens to look, I don't know, let's say 2-3 years in the future, what do you hope is an AI-based product that or tool that can get built? Like, what do you wish was being worked on right now or is being built within the next couple of years?
I hope people are building AI tools around the new capability for methane sensing in climate change. So what's happening is like new satellites are being launched that can sense methane from the sky. So I hope people are building tools around holding people accountable, holding companies accountable to the methane that they emit. Now that we know where it's being emitted, that would be great. You know, would be great for the planet. So it's stuff like that. You know, I feel like AI is a really powerful tool because, like, in this same example, right, climate change. At the same time, the Big Oil is also investing heavily in AI exploration, right? You can imagine how useful it is to find oil under the ground where you can analyze stuff like that. So, you know, I hope it gets used for good, not for evil, in multiple areas, yeah.
I was not expecting an answer, but I like it a lot.
Thanks, Peter. It's been wonderful chatting.
Thank you so much for listening today. Please remember to subscribe to our podcast, The Design of AI, on Apple or Spotify, or visit our website, designof.ai.